I mean, really, you know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hello.
I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything there is, you know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than money. I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than sex. I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than my job, my car, my mom, my family, friends, all of them. And the reason is, without Alcoholics Anonymous, none of those things mean much to a guy like me. And so I have you to thank for my life. Are we doing all right? It's an honor and privilege to be here. It's a privilege to get the opportunity to take an action in defense of my own recovery and to get to connect to you. I'm not a giant fan of this whole speaking thing, but I am a huge fan of getting to connect with people. And it's a real big deal for me to be specifically at this conference. I served a host in Phoenix in 2007, the last time it was in Phoenix. And we held a meeting in this room. And Alonzo, our speaker from last night, I was on the host for them. And Alonzo nominated me for advisory. And I served advisory for the last 5 years. Rotated off just last year. And my last vote as advisory was to vote for it to come to Phoenix.
Thanks,
Eric. I have no response. That's just what happened. So it's just really cool. It's really cool. What's also cool is that I lost count of how many times I've been locked up at the jail. It's like less than a half a block away. So if the Mesa PD is listening, F you. Couple of quick disclaimers. One is, if I should say something that can't be rectified by the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd suggest you disregard it. Two, I have a great deal of love and respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, for its first step, third tradition, and singleness of purpose. So I'm going to try not to talk about any drug use. Like a buddy of mine, Larry, says, if I'd have known that I was going to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have done all them drugs. But it has happened that way, right? And third and lastly, I believe that we should be respectful in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to try to watch my language, but I'll probably fuck that up. There's that. And the last is a request. The last is a request, and that's to please laugh. You laugh with me, laugh at me. I don't care. It's healing, and it's good for the soul. And I think if we take this thing too seriously, it loses its power. You know, it loses its juice. And what a cool deal, right? I mean, the host committee did an amazing job. Advisory, everybody. You can't help but to come to a thing like this and be changed forever. You know, you can't take part in this thing. You can't come and fully engage over the course of a day or days, or if you're on host for a period of time, and walk away unchanged. It's just not possible, you know? And we walk away from things like this, and we go, I still don't understand God, you know? And I think that what that's about is that we seek God as a noun, right? We seek God in a person, place, thing, or an idea. And we lose God in that place. But if we see God as a verb, right, that which helps me to transcend me, to connect to you, God is here. God is here now. And that's all there is, you know? It's like, this is a stupid little story I love, you know? It's about two fish, right? Pardon me. There's these two little fish, right? And they're both swimming, and they sort of find each other, and one fish says to the other fish, you looked lost. What's wrong? And the other fish says, man, I'm looking for water, you know? And the fish goes, wow, man, that's crazy. I haven't seen it, but if I do, I'll let you know. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That's me and you sitting around going, man, I'm going to find this God thing one day, you know? This is it, you know? This is it. And I love the theme, raised from the dead. This is the story of my life. I mean, look around you. This is Avalon, the island of the dead. You know? This is a bunch of dead psychotic people sitting upright pretending to be alive. You know? Someone asked me before the meeting if I was nervous or if I was, you know, fearful. It's like, it's just one lunatic's turn to address the asylum. And there'll be another lunatic later, you know? And that's all this thing is, right? You can't take it all too seriously. So, I don't have a whole bunch of time. Did someone start a timer? Just kick me or something. So, I don't have a whole bunch of time. I'm just a fluffer. And, just call it like I see it. So, I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous on Friday the 13th, January of 2006. I weighed 117 pounds. I was bluish-yellow, semi-translucent. You can sort of see my veins through my skin. I was completely psychotic. I mean, the only thing that stood between me and a padded cell was like a solid psychological evaluation. And, and I got here and I'd come straight out of county jail for what the state of Arizona says was my 20th time. Upon arrival at Lower Buckeye Jail, I was charged with a felony too for distributing methamphetamines in that jail, while on a probation violation for possession of heroin. And they started to look at my record, which had a lot of stuff in it, like aggravated assaults and criminal damage, and discharging firearms and aggravated DUI and DUI, all the way back to when I was a kid, minor possessions, all that stuff. And I had absolutely no tools for living, you know? Absolutely no tools for living. And I got one tool, and that's a bottle in a bag, that's it. In fact, practice better living through chemistry, you know? And I'm not under the belief that that I need to get sober. Like, being sober is not a solution for a guy like me, you know? I mean, out there in the rest of the world, the non-addict, non-alcoholic people, you take away the bottle and the bag and their life starts to fall apart, you know? When the cracks start to appear, it starts to crumble, you know, they're hitting a little hard. You take away the bottle and the bag, they get better. They show up to work on time. They're able to connect to people. They become honest again. They start to put their lives back together when you take the thing away, you know? What happens for me, and if you're anything like me, is that you take away the medicine and I get worse. I fall apart, you know? I'm broken in a real, real way, very much on the inside, you know? In here where I live, it's broken. And if you can't give me a sufficient substitute for whiskey, heroin, and speed, no deal, man. No deal. Right? My man understands. And that's what we have here, right? That is what we have here, is a sufficient substitute. And I crashed into here, and I was tens of thousands of dollars in debt. I'd been living in my car prior to that incarceration, and I mean, it was a decent car, but it made a really shitty house. And I'd given it up for bail to come to find you guys, so that sort of left me residentially challenged. And just before that arrest, which was the day after Christmas in 2005, just before that arrest, I'd heard something I'd never heard before, which is a gentleman had approached me, one of you guys, just an everyday, average, goddamn hero, rolled up on me. I didn't come looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. Guys like me don't come looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys found me. You know? Psychotic. You found me. And say, you don't have to live this way. You don't have to die this way if you don't want to. And you said, what do you think? There's a way out. And I said, I'm really busy. I gotta go. Thanks. I mean, that's what you would say, right? But what happened is, I told you what happened. The guy prayed for me. And so the day after Christmas, 2005, I was arrested at Home Depot for borrowing some things I wasn't going to return. And one more time, I'm home away from home, you know? And I come to sometime in January. I don't remember New Year's. It wasn't a party. There wasn't champagne and toasts. You know, there was no New Year's kiss. And I came to in county jail one more time. And I'd been a hope-to-die alcoholic for the last 10 years of my life at that point. And I mean the kind of alcoholic where I come to and am immediately disappointed by being alive, you know? And my greatest hope is that if all goes well, I won't have to come to this god-awful nightmare again tomorrow. And that's how I live. And I lived that way for the last 10 years I was alive. Or the last 10 years I was loaded. And I came to in county jail, and there was just this voice from deep within. And it was very pure and simple. And it said, man, if you're not gonna die, you better goddamn well figure out how to live, cause this sucks. And I called a dude and put my truck for bail. Called a girl to take my truck and turn it to the bail bondsman. It took her like a week. I don't know, I think she's a tweaker, you know, and so she had alphabetized the papers in the glove box or something. And I got out and I came to find you guys on Friday the 13th, January 2006. I walked through the front doors of the treatment center and I met you guys. And it was a full moon. And I found you guys. And I fell in love with you from the day we met. And I've been in love with you ever since. I mean that sincerely. There have been times here and there where I didn't like you so much. But I've always been in love with you. Absolutely, hopelessly in love with you. And the reason is this, is that I got here, it was clear to me that you guys had the answers I needed. You guys had answers I've been looking for my whole life. You know? It was clear to me that you guys vibrated on the same frequency. It was clear to me that you'd been where I'd been, done what I'd done, thought how I thought, felt how I felt, had found a way out, and were okay being sober. And that was baffling to me. It was absolutely baffling to me. And what you said to me...
How am I doing on time?
I got like 2 minutes?
Perfect.
What you said to me here's a book, you know? Here's a book. And I was like, I'm on my way to prison, and you have a book. And you guys are like, yeah, it's an awesome book. And I was like, yeah, but I mean, the only person that hates me more than my mother is me, you know? You guys said, awesome, here's a book. And you know, it's like the story, on and on and on and on and on. I'm unemployable and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You guys are like, great, here's a book. And, I mean, I'm from Mesa, so like, I've been pushed some blue books before, you know? I wasn't sure about your weird little blue book, you know? But the thing that was undeniable was you, right? The thing that was undeniable was your very presence, your very stance against the world, your very being sober, your very seeking to become free, and it was appealing to me. I mean, let's face it, being sober is super sexy, you know what I mean? Growing spiritually is a beautiful thing, you know what I mean? I mean, here's what it is, right? I'll sum this whole thing up in a simple idea. That to grow spiritually is not about attainment. There's nothing to get here. There's nothing to get. It's about detachment, right? It's about write an inventory, find out what's not me. I'm pure, I'm whole, it's buried beneath garbage, right? And so we come here and we write inventory and we make amends and we constantly look inward and we seek and we share and we grow in order to outgrow me by connecting to you. And the process is this, is a process of purification, right? I don't mean some creepy religious term. I mean very simple and practical term in that it's like water, right? The fundamental element of life. That water is whole. You don't add water to make better water. You don't, right? Like you remove what's not pure and what's left is good water, you know? And that's this process. That's the simple, practical process of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you come here and you're like, you know, sure about this, it all seems very, you know, religious or new agey or just super weird and I don't like to hold hands and chant and hug, I get it, man, right? But the reality of it is this works. Alcoholics Anonymous works. and it works incredibly well, right? I take meetings into that same jail I was charged with distributing methamphetamines in, right? That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a multiple felon and was offered a job in a corporation like earlier this year, like a big corporation, like a real big guy job, you know what I mean? I don't know how it happens, you know? Like, I can't explain it, right? The law of improbability doesn't apply here. That's all I can tell you. The law of improbability doesn't apply here. The unthinkable is doable here, right? And that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think I'm out of time. I'm really looking forward to hearing our speaker, Camille. And if you're new, we have this book. In it are the 12 steps outlined in the first 164 pages. Suggested you take them with a sponsor. And in the process between 1 and 12, the magic happens. That sufficient substitute, when done properly, transpires. And that thing I was looking for in the bottle in the bag all those years, that here's what it has. If you like me, I can describe it without words. It's this. Here's what I was looking for. Yeah. Right? I got that. You gave it to me. I love you. Thanks.
Pleased to announce that Miss Camille from Tucson is our main speaker. Hi, I'm Camille, an alcoholic.
Hi, Camille! We love you, Camille!
Having me here, it's a fantastic honor, and I wanted to thank Eric. That was lovely. If you're the fluffer, what does that make me? I don't know if I'm willing. It's really special for me to be here because my first experience with YPAW was at an ASCIPAW 6 or 7 years ago. And I was raised in rigid AA, and I came to you guys, and the main speaker that night got up and was so incredibly crass and inappropriate and just across the board, like, fantastic. And there were people getting up and walking out, and I swore that I was never going to participate in YPAW ever again. And thus began my journey in YPAW. And what I've found is, through participation in standing service committees and in Wacky Paw Host, was that there's a verve and a passion amongst us young peoples that we are the keepers of AA. And it's an incredibly inspiring thing for me to watch members of the young people's community stand up at area conferences and passionately defend the traditions and to participate in something like this where there's so much fun involved and there's just a real spirit to it. So it speaks to my heart, and I'm really grateful to be here. My sobriety date is September 17th of 2005. That is not my original sobriety date. I came into AA on May 17th of 2005, and on September 16th I drank, and the next day I was at a conference, and I was sitting next to my sponsor, and during the countdown she nudged me for 4 months, so I stood up, and then I lied about my sobriety date for the next 6 years. Thank you. And I share that for several reasons. The first one is to lower your expectations. And the second one is that was really one of those things that I'm sitting in the rooms and like, I'm taking that to my grave. You know, I will share with you the sordid parts of my sexual inventory, but I won't tell you that I'm a liar, you know? And I think there's real power in standing up here in front of so many people and saying that was the thing, you know, that I wasn't going to tell. And I there's a lot of freedom in that for me. I was maladjusted to life before I ever took my first drink. One of the things that I noticed in me was that I got resentments really early on, and I didn't have the proper tools to deal with them. The one that sticks out in my head is I was in preschool. It was Halloween, and I was Pocahontas, warrior princess, which I thought was amazing because I got weapons. And I've always been a big thing about weapons. And there was this other little girl in my class who was like blonde hair and blue eyed, and she was beautiful, and she dressed up as Bridal Barbie, and I hated her. And I went with it, and I, you know, instead of, like, I don't know, pulling her hair or something normal, I plotted and I planned, and I got my mom to invite her over to the house about 4 months later for a play date, and I lured her down into our basement, and I locked her in there and shut off the lights. Like, really, that was my only option. And I'm really glad I found you guys. I took my first drink at the age of 12. My sister was also one of us, and she had some mental health issues. She tried to commit suicide several times, and when I was 12 years old, she poured a bottle of Bacardi all over herself and lit herself on fire, and didn't die, you know, because I don't think we die quick, painless deaths in here. We die slow, painful ones. And my response to that was not to talk about my fifis. It was, you know, to find the bottle of Bacardi and drink, because there was something intuitive in me that understood that there was a solution there. And I was off to the races. I never drank socially, or I would dress it up as social drinking, but that wasn't my intention. You know, I was the kind of drinker that would drink Chardonnay before school because that was classy, and then drink Robitussin during the day, you know. It was a study aid. I don't know. It calmed me down. You know, I like this idea. When my mom asked me about what drinking does for me, you know, for her, she has a drink and she starts to feel out of control and she doesn't like that feeling. I have a drink and I start to feel in control, you know, and that's been my experience. I was a really good kid. I was a good student. I was, you know, in National Honor Society, and I was the president of Students Against Drunk Driving. Later turned out to be ironic. And, you know, I presented something to you. It was very important to me that you saw what I wanted you to see. And I had a lot of different masks for a lot of different days. And it got exhausting, you know. And so by the time I was 18, I was college bound. You know, I had everything locked up. And I got a call in high school, and it was like, you know, you got to get to the ICU. Your sister's in the ICU. And I thought to myself, well, it's another suicide attempt, another cry for hope. And I, you know, drug my butt over there, and I hadn't seen her for about a year. She was agoraphobic, and I walked into the ICU, and it turns out she had small cell lung cancer. It spread to her liver and her bloodstream. She had Hep C from her needle use, and she had tuberculosis, you know. And she was dead within 2 weeks. But what they said to me was, Camille, you better say goodbye to your sister today. And so I said goodbye to my sister, and what was important about that for me to tell you is that I wasn't sober when I did it. I wasn't able to express to her how meaningful her role was in my life. 2 weeks later, my father made the decision to take her off life support, and in my mind, that was tantamount to him killing her. So I didn't speak to him for another 4 years. You know, he lost his daughter to alcoholism, and I didn't speak to my dad. They didn't sit with her while she was dying, so I went in and sat with her, and her husband asked me to read Psalm 23. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. And it was so empty. You know, so empty. I had no experience with God. I had experience with seeking God and alcohol, certainly, but I had no experience with God. And any little smidgen of that existed for me was gone, because look what God did to me. And that's how I live my life. And you know, I became a continuous, everyday, all day drinker. When I was 21 years old, I had the experience of coming out of a blackout. I was a blackout drinker, with a busted lip and some bruised ribs. And it, you know, it wasn't the first time that had happened. I had suffered several indignities of being an alcoholic woman. But what didn't get me was the injuries. It was looking in the mirror and realizing that was the best I could do. And so I called my mommy, and she hadn't found Al-Anon yet, so she had a binder ready of all the rehabs that I could go to, and she said she'd come get me. And so I got off the phone with her, and what was really important about that experience was that when I was on the phone with her, I didn't want to drink again. Like, I desperately, every fiber of my being didn't want to drink again. And when I set the phone down, it was within 5 minutes that I had to drink. And having that kind of experience of powerlessness and not knowing what it was at 21 years old was a terrifying prospect. So she came and got me. I ended up in a rehab, a 30-day program that I very lovingly refer to as the psycho spa, you know, because it was like you go to group therapy and then you go get a tan and then you, you know, go get some acupuncture and they make really good food. And they asked me to make a triggers list, and I was like, okay. So it was like pages and pages of the most random stuff, like cauliflower, ketchup, Halloween, you know, like everything. And but because I didn't understand that as an alcoholic, like waking up in the morning is my trigger. I left there with a lot of knowledge, and I could give you the Webster definition of alcoholism, and I had a lot of notes because I'm a good student. And what I didn't hear when I was there was that I needed power greater than myself to overcome my drinking. So I left there thinking Camille's got this, and I made it 3 months. And what I also heard there was that I was supposed to be altruistic, which is unselfishly giving of myself. So I was driving around. I was living up in Portland at the time. I was driving around Portland with many bottles of tequila in my glove compartment. And my reasoning behind that was that there were a lot of panhandlers. And I thought to myself, well, these people are trying to get changed to buy alcohol, so what I'm gonna do, being the altruistic person, is I'm just gonna give them the alcohol, and they don't have to go to the liquor store, and that's my service. And it didn't work. I didn't get out the tequila, you know? And my experience was that I suffered one of those strange mental blind spots. I don't remember drinking it. You know, I don't remember looking at that mini bottle and thinking through it. You know, I had the experience of taking that drink without being able to say to myself, I'm gonna lose my education, my family, the trust of my friends, my dignity. I'm not, you know, it didn't happen. And I drank. And thus began another 9 months of drinking. At the end of that, I had a Rottweiler and a feral cat, and not a lot of friends, and a Subaru with bloodstains all over it. And I don't know how there's bloodstains there, but I ended up driving to northern New Mexico because that's where my mom was, and she didn't want me living in the same town as her, but she put me in this house about 30 minutes north of Taos, this town called Valdez, and there's like 200 people there, 300 sheep, like a lot of guns, and a post office, and I thought, okay, I can manage this, like this is my zone, you know? And I made it 2 weeks drinking there, you know? And what I would do is I would go up the road from me, and there was this little beautiful New Mexico graveyard up there, and I'd go sit outside of it and drink. And I knew I had to give the sobriety thing another shot because I had had the experience of lucidity. Like I'd eaten well, you know, like sometimes that's all that matters. And so I booked myself a bed in the county detox for the next day, and I went and got plastered because I figure if you're going to detox, you have to make them work for it. And so I got very drunk, and a voice spoke to me. And for the longest time, I couldn't acknowledge that that was the voice of grace. But what that voice said to me was, Camille, no matter what you do, you're going to drink again. And that was the first time that it hadn't occurred to me that there was something that could fix me. You know, I had tried so many things. I had gotten tickets to go see the Dalai Lama speak, you know, which is like an epic thing. But I stopped at the bar, you know, before I went and heard the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, you know, and I was, it was just two. I was just gonna have two, to hear the message, man. And missed it. You know, I missed it. So there were always things, the self-help books, the white picket fence, the education, the hymn, that was gonna fix me. And this was the first time in my life I'd experienced that feeling of knowing, like to my core, that there was nothing. And even the thought of Alcoholics Anonymous occurred to me, and it wasn't gonna do it. And so my next thought was, I don't want to die like my sister, so I'll just do it now. I tried to slit my wrist, but I also have vanity issues, so I didn't. If it didn't work out, I didn't want scars. I failed. What a miserable thing to fail at suicide. So I ended up in detox the next day, and I walked in there. My ego rebuilds itself very quickly. So I walked into this detox, and there was a gentleman coming in with me who has he had leg irons on and a prison jumpsuit on, and he was a Tiwa Indian man. And I looked at him, and I said, I'm better than you. I don't belong here. And I told the people, give me 3 days, give me the drugs, and I got this. And I've had many, many angels in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that man was one of them, because that night he beat me in Scrabble. And that was enough. That was enough for me to say to myself, like, maybe I'm not that smart.